Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and I'm very honoured today to be joined by Jim Carter, who has joined us to talk about his book, Hearts of Steel, which is it's quite an extraordinary story of his great-grandfather, a Royal Navy sailor who served on 3 battleships, and it's a kind of history, as a personal history, but it's a wider history of the Royal Navy in peacetime and war. So welcome, Jim. It's a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on. That's it's great to be here. Nice to be talking to you.
And so the book itself began as a kind of a local history project, didn't it? It was looking at the war memorial and the closer to you, and then there, this family connection emerged.
It's 2014, wasn't it? 2014, there was a project that a lot of people around the country got involved with to look at the names on war memorials and then investigate the background of those guys. I'm sure I'm not the only one that used to look at these war memorials and think about these fellas and who they were. So I was working on that at the time. And then my mother gave me my great-grandfather's service record from the Royal Navy. Now, I'd previously, my grandmother had given me a book called War at Sea, in which she'd annotated a few little notes in there about him. And I knew that he'd been in the Navy, and I knew that he'd been on a tribal class destroyer called HMS Nubian. So I'd had a little bit of a delve into that. But when I got hold of his service record, I realized, he joined in 1918 and just to in July of 1918, just before the war ended. And then he signed on, like many people did in those days, for 12 years. So that took him through the interwar years. And then he was on Nubian from her launch and commissioning in 1939 through to her being bombed and attacked in 1941, after which he then was shore-based for the rest of the war. But right. I'm kind of not surprised, because at the start of the war, he was, almost 40 then. So he was a very experienced guy, but he's working towards the end of his career and not expecting to go to war, I think.
Sure. Am I right in thinking he'd been on 3 warships in that time? Is that correct?
Well, he'd actually been on nearly 16 of them. But what I basically had to do is condense it down to 3 of the more significant ones. So two were cruisers that he went out to the East Indies on, to the East Indies station. And in those days, a commission was 2.5 years duration. So he was away from his family for 2.5 years at a time at that point. And then I picked up obviously on Nubian because she was a very important destroyer in historical terms, because she's the second highest decorated ship of the Second World War. So
right.
And he was on board for most of her battle honours. So she's not particularly well known about. So I thought we ought to write that kind of wrong and bring her to the fore.
And this period of time, it's an interesting period of time if you're looking at battleships, because you go through a number of things. Firstly, there is a kind of a period in peacetime, there's a period of austerity and spending cuts, which
Yep.
see, you know, lead to things like a mutiny at Invergordon, which is slightly overstated, but, you know, nonetheless. And also cuts to the naval budget. There are all sorts of negotiations with America and the five power, the Washington Conference and things like that. So you see a kind of a smaller, I don't know how much smaller, Royal Navy by 1939, but it's smaller.
Yeah, it was still pretty powerful. I mean, it hadn't reduced in a massive number. I mean, it's at the review for King George's review. It was there was over 100 ships there,
right?
In five lines that stretched 10 miles,
right?
And so it was still pretty huge. And you have to remember that at that review, there was that was only part of the Navy. You know, there was still stuff overseas because we still had quite a big reach at that time.
Yeah.
So but you're right. I mean, it definitely contracted. It had been contracted in numbers and the like, but then by sort of 1938, we were ramping up quickly
Carol. No, so I was going to say it's the other thing to mention is that the Second World War is almost, it's the twilight of the battleship, isn't it? We're starting
absolutely
to see something, other forms of naval warfare emerge.
Yes,
and by probably the early 1950s, most of our battleships are no more. Which is, there are, I saw film footage, I think from about 1946, of just huge shipyards of these things rusting away, which is kind of tragic, really.
Being broken up, yeah. Well, really, that was down to the realization that aircraft and aircraft carriers were a real projection of power. The Royal Navy took a little while, funnily enough. We see ourselves as big supporters of aircraft carriers and the like, but in the early days, they were very much about protecting the fleet. And it was the Americans that were actually saying, well, really, these things are a projection of power, and they're like massive forward artillery. You know, so a battleship could fire a shell sort of 15, 20 miles maximum inland at any one time, whereas an aircraft could fly hundreds of miles off an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
So that really saw the demise, you know, the rethinking that actually a battleship doesn't have much use in forward projection of power, whereas an aircraft carrier does.
And we now, I mean, it's an interesting parallel with now, as we're starting to enter into new forms of warfare where, you know, drones and things like that are perhaps going to make all sorts of things obsolete. So your great grandfather sees active service from 1939 to 41. Am I correct in thinking the majority of that is in the Mediterranean at that time?
Yes, it is. But he started off. Nubian took part in some convoy duty up to Norway at the start of the Second World War, and then she was involved in the Norwegian campaign. And mainly in the delivery of troops into the port of Namsos to try and take Trondheim. And that didn't last particularly long, actually. It was a bit of a fiasco. But she was heavily involved in going backwards and forwards to that. And she was really a command and control boat at the time, because she had his name now. She had the general who was looking after the troops. on board a lot of time using her as a command and control back to the UK.
Right.
So that was the first bit. And then she went out to the once the Norwegian campaign was kind of over, she went straight out to the Eastern Mediterranean. And that's where she stayed for the until May 1941, just at the end of Crete, where she got bombed.
Right, right. And sunk or survived?
No, she was she survived. And it's quite an incredible story, actually, because her whole of her back end got blown away. So she lost Y turret, which is the one at the back. And the whole back end was blown off, but they could still use the engines. So the rudder was jammed, but she could still move. So they managed to get her back to Alexandria,
right,
steering the boat on the propellers. And they got attacked on the way. They got attacked on the way back, but they made it back. And
yeah.
So it was pretty cool.
Because I mean, Crete, one of these sort of great kind of early to mid war disasters. I mean, Greece and Crete, in fact, were the sort of really ill-fated campaigns. Crete is essentially a route, isn't it? We have to kind of evacuate via sea, and it's sort of like a Mediterranean Dunkirk almost, isn't it? Having to get the men off.
Well, that's right. I mean, that period of the war, from Norway was the first big evacuation. Then you had Dunkirk. And then, of course, you had Greece and Crete come along. So there's one after the other. Greece was interesting, because one thing a lot of people sort of forget or overlook is that there was Operation Compass going on in North Africa, which was the rout of the Italian army. Pushed them all the way back nearly to Tripoli. And once they got there was huge pressure to go and help the Greeks.
Yeah.
And so half of the troops and the equipment was taken away from North Africa and sent to Greece. And then, of course, Rommel arrives and pushes everybody back, the British right back to Alexandria. And the Germans attack Greece and push us out of Greece. So, it's one sort of disaster after another at that point in time.
Yes. And with looking at your great grandfather and the research that you've done, what was your sense of how he coped throughout all of this? What was his experience like?
Well, all I could do was go because I didn't have any personal information on him, so all I could do was look at writings and notes of people that were around him. I would have said that they're wrapped up in their job. It was probably moments of sheer terror, with bits of boredom thrown in there as well, as they say.
Yeah.
But when you look at some of the commanding officers and what they've written, they were incredibly frightened at times, because they were getting bombed daily, and they just never knew that. You know, you're stuck inside a tin can on the sea. You can't get off. Whatever, you can't walk away. So I think he probably coped, but I would almost definitely say he had some form of PTSD or something, because the only evidence I've got of that is that I used to ask my grandmother and grandfather, what did you do in the war? And I probably should have asked them what great grandfather did, but they never mentioned him at all. And grandmother only had these little notes that she wrote to me. So that kind of says to me that he didn't talk about it.
No.
So, I think obviously that's fairly typical that people bottled it up.
Well, we were lucky on this podcast a while back to have Damien Lewis, who's written lots of books on the SAS. And one of the really interesting things he talked about was trauma. I think he said that he'd done one of his books in association with a trauma psychologist, and they looked at when you look at some of the early SAS missions, what they did, the numbers that got killed, the things they had to do, the people that they killed, is kind of beyond belief, really. But actually, the human cost of that, what that leaves a human being is like after that, It's kind of, I think this is a bit that's often left out of history books. You know, you read like tales of D-Day derring do and things like that. And actually, going up one of those beaches would probably have scarred you for life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's another interesting point that there was the surgeon commander on board Nubian with my great grandfather. He wrote a paper on morale and trauma that was made into a fleet order. And he looked at the way that people react differently to stress, combat stress. And it's like a bank account. You gradually use up this account of bravery, as it were, or morale. And that in the end, once that's gone, that's gone. And that was used by Lord Moran in his book, The Anatomy of Courage. Yeah, and I've managed to find it actually. The Naval Review have got a it got lost, this paper that he wrote, but he managed to rewrite bits of it, and that was published in the Naval Review. And it's fascinating, you know, really talking about it's so important to keep the morale of the sailors up, to keep and leadership was key to all that. And yeah, that was quite a good great find, really.
A lot of the time, I think you had, and it's probably to do with institutions and social class and a whole bunch of other stuff, but you find particular branches of the armed services during the war very much resistant to new thinking. New ideas about how you fight battles and how you direct the men and things like that. And I wonder whether ideas about morale and taking care of the mental well-being of your soldiers and your sailors was something that kind of either fell on deaf ears or that was kind of resisted at all. What do you think?
I think certainly down in the East of Med, to think that that paper, which was possibly quite groundbreaking at the time, was circulated to the fleet, the Eastern Mediterranean fleet, was probably a good indication that they were thinking about this. And certainly down there.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Those destroyers were almost constantly at sea and constantly being attacked, you know, and to those guys were based in Alexandria, were thousands of miles from home. They had no chance of going home anytime soon on leave or whatever. Mail took ages to get to them. So that, yeah, it's interesting that I think they were trying to make sure that those guys were looked after and kept positive as much as possible.
Yes. And then gradually, you know, the war in the Mediterranean is won, and it's the winning of the war of them in the Mediterranean that kind of dooms the Africa Corps, the German Africa Corps in North Africa. The more successful Rommel is, the longer his supply lines get, and the more you need to have Resupplies from probably occupied southern France, I would imagine they were sailing from. And so the role of the do you get the sense that in the Mediterranean it was the Navy that won the Mediterranean War, or the Air Force? What's your feeling?
I think it was a combination of the two in the end, because the big losses that we had at Crete were certainly down to a lack of air cover. You know, there'd been the Battle of Britain. There was, I think it was Lee Mallory kept back the fighters to do these ramrod raids into France, and was very late in sending anything out to Malta to provide air cover for the ships. And they, you know, they were realizing that ships can't, the doctrine that a battleship can always fight off air cover was proven wrong time and time again. And it wasn't until they sent fighter aircraft down there in big numbers that you know that changed it. So it was, the Navy couldn't have done it on its own.
No,
not at all.
No,
and that was the turning point, getting the air cover down there for them.
And I suppose the war, I mean, if you look at the example of the First World War, one of the kind of the revisionist things that's said about the generals, people like Haig obviously come in for an awful lot of criticism, but there are various sort of revisionist book accounts that say, you know, the First World War is what this calls bloody learning curve, that going from the Somme to, say, like the Battle of Amiens, they finally, by 1918, have worked out how to do it. And I suppose the Second World War is that on a much bigger scale, because we're talking about multiple fronts, well, many more fronts, and also the coordination of quite a lot of new technologies. So
yes,
I guess that there's an example of that right there.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. You know, sort of after 41, 42, you know, the British and the British forces, or the Allied forces, are really, really learning very quickly how to do modern warfare again. The Germans have got a bit of a leap on them, but they really learnt fast. And of course, then they had the industrial might behind them of the United States and the new technologies that were coming out of there. So, it became a technological war for sure.
And we talked about the two campaigns, talked about Norway and the Mediterranean, but of course, perhaps the biggest campaign and longest naval campaign of the war is the Battle of the Atlantic.
Absolutely,
I'm guessing your great grandfather didn't have any role in that. Is that correct?
No, he didn't, because he was in Norway first, then the East of Med, and then he stayed on a shore base. He was posted up to Bizerta. Which I would have said he was there for the build-up of Operation Husky. So no, he wasn't in the.
So when he was on shore, he had just an administrative kind of role.
Yep, I think it was basically just administration. You know, I'd like to think that they said, well, you've done your bit. You've done 2.5 years frontline duty. You're in your 40s. Go and have a quiet job.
Just to kind of round things out and talk a bit about this kind of other campaign. I know that he wasn't involved, but during the Battle of the Atlantic, you have again an old style system initially. The convoy system, which had been used during the First World War. Bizarrely, as First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill sends out the Ark Royal into the to chase submarines, and that ends predictably disastrously. My grandfather was on the second Ark Royal.
All right.
Yes, there's a guy who built Sea Spitfires, which apparently came in large cardboard boxes, and it was like a game of sort of Meccano. But yes, thankfully he wasn't on the first one. But the convoy system is another example of kind of military innovation, isn't it? To use new technologies and tactics to deal with this kind of really serious problem of U-boat wolf packs.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you've got ASDIC obviously coming along, radar coming along, and things like Hedgehog, you know, with it rather than just depth charges, a Hedgehog system that fired out multiple devices. So yeah, there was a lot going on, and radar was a massive development, and initially radar was assigned to all those ships in the Atlantic. Very few ships in the Eastern Med had radar at all.
Right.
They were only fitted as a refit, basically.
Wow.
So yeah. So for instance, during one operation that Nubian was on, there was four destroyers assigned out of Malta to go and strike at the Italian convoys supplying North Africa. And there was only one of those ships that had radar, which was HMS Janus, and she'd just been refitted. So it was it was so new, it was bit, they were trying to use it where they really needed it. And then if they did have it in the Eastern Med, then they tried to use that as effectively as possible with one having radar amongst a bunch. So
yeah. And I get the sense sometimes with things like radar that you had senior commanders who maybe they're given this new thing, and they almost don't know what they don't know about it. They don't know why they have it or why it's important or what it does or what it prevents until obviously something really bad happens.
So we could have done with that.
Very often, very often kind of like that. So just before we finish up, just a bit of about the book. How long did it take you to write all of this? How long? What was the research and the writing like for you?
So it took me probably 3 years to write it. The accelerating factor, like so many people, was COVID. You know, there was not much else to do, so I cracked on with it during there.
Yeah.
But I loved the research side of it. I like going up to the Imperial War Museum and going up to the National Archives. Amazing organisations. It's unbelievable what's online. And, and I was really trying to uncover every little bit that I could about any slight connection that Nubian had with something. I wanted to include that. So that was great. And the writing process was good fun. And I really enjoyed it. Yeah, it was good.
Is this your first and only foray into military history, or do you have the bug now? Do you think you'll go forward and write other things, research other things?
Well, I've just written a couple of articles that are going in some publications shortly, and I've been asked to do a talk on the, believe it or not, on the Fleet Air Arm for the Boscombe Down Aviation Society. That's in November. And out the back of that, I've been thinking about maybe writing another book around carriers and the like. I've always been into my aviation. I'm a private pilot, so I love flying as much as anything. So that would be a nice combination to do something along those lines.
Well, do when you're ready with something, you know, that you've researched, give us a shout, because it would always be a pleasure to talk about it. And I love on this channel to, you know, sometimes talk to people who've written, you know, best-selling books, and sometimes I really want to talk to historians who've got niche kind of areas that they've researched, because those are just as important.
Absolutely.
I was going to say the book details. So Hearts of Steel: Peace and War in the Royal Navy, 1918 to 1941, is available. Am I right in thinking on June the 6th? Is that correct?
It's available now. You can get it now. So it's on Amazon. You can order it off the bookshops. There's an Audible version as well.
Right.
So, yeah. Right. All forms. Forms.
Fabulous. So there you go. It's available now, folks. Please, if you can, order from an independent bookshop. They need your help.
Absolutely.
And particularly independent military bookshops, of which they're a dying breed, and we've got to support them. So please do your bit, as they say.
Great. I remembered the general's name. It's General Carton de Wyatt from Norway.
I thought it was him.
Yeah.
He was a very eccentric guy. Definitely of the old breed.
Yeah.
Practice. Oh, okay. Well, Jim, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Likewise.
Look forward to the book coming out, and please do check back in with us because it'd be a great chat.
I'll keep in touch. All the best. Thanks, Nick.
All the best. I'll just.